On Sunday, June 26th at 11 p.m., Sugar in My Bowl presents part two of our discussion with percussionist, drummer, composer, Andrew Cyril. Join us as we continue to discuss Andrew Cyril's career and his interest in teaching. That's Sunday, June 26th at 11 p.m., right here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program. My name is Joyce Jones. We'll be wrapping up our extended Vision Festival coverage with part two of a conversation with Andrew Cyril. Stay tuned. You'll be hearing from the bandstand on the bandstand segment with our associate producer, Hank Williams. But we're going to start off the program the way we ended during part one, and that would be on the subject of Cecil Taylor. Stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl, coming up now.
So they'll go. What's the matter, Daddy? Come on, save my soul. I want some sugar in my bowl. Sugar in my bowl.
My name's Joyce Jones, and I'm on the line with...
Andrew Cyril.
Andrew Cyril, thank you once again for joining Sugar in My Bowl.
Well, it's my pleasure, Joyce. I had a good time doing the show the last time, and I say hello.
Thank you for part two. Now, I want to start off our discussion pretty much where we ended, which was with Cecil Taylor, and you're moving on from playing with him. But there's somebody that Cecil Taylor would always talk about when I saw him. He would have very fond memories of Mary Lou Williams. And I understand you have a relationship with Mary Lou Williams as well.
Yeah, I had a pretty close relationship with Mary. As a matter of fact, I was the one who introduced both of them to each other.
Ah.
And we did that in London. I forget what year that was. I think Mary was playing in town that night, and Cecil and I and Jimmy Lyons were playing also. And for some reason, the three of us got together and went to a Greek restaurant and had dinner and, you know, started talking about things. And that's when the both of them met. And then after that, I think there used to be a place on 8th Street and University. It was a club. I can't remember the name of it, but Mary used to play in there all the time. Cecil used to go down and listen to her quite often, saying she'd have a duo, you know, with bass players like Milton Suggs. I'm not sure who else. Oh, yeah, Ronnie Boykin played with her on occasion. So Cecil would go in there and sit and listen to her, and then they got together and did that concert at Carnegie Hall.
I think it's called Embrace.
Embrace, exactly. But, of course, I had known Mary when I was going to Juilliard, so that was maybe about 19, 20 years old or something like that. And actually, I met Mary through a bass player who said she was looking for a drummer. The bass player's name was Alex Lane, and Alex told me that Mary was looking for a drummer. So we both went up there, and I met her, and that's how it began.
So what was it like working with Mary Lou Williams for you?
Well, it was, of course, a great privilege, and it was also a learning experience. Many of the things that I had learned just in order to get the gig were also enhanced by working with her. The kind of tunes we would play, how she would ask me to do certain things. And the bass player, too, was George Tucker, an extraordinary bass player for the majority of time that I worked with Mary. I think George was from Florida, but he lived uptown in Harlem. I had known George for a little bit also. You know, Mary, she and I had gotten pretty close because she had that organization called Bel Canto Foundation, and it was to help musicians who were in need. And her vision was to have a place, in a sense, outside of New York City where musicians could go and stay if they needed to have some place to live. I don't know if it would have been permanent, but it could have been some place where they could just get themselves together so they could get back out on the scene. So she was a very charitable person that way. She was very loving in terms of wanting to help people, and in this particular situation, musicians in need. And in that store, Bel Canto, it's interesting, the name Bel Canto, a beautiful song, she would collect clothing. And I'm not sure what she did with the clothing, whether it was distributed to people or whether it was given to the Goodwill or the Salvation Army or something like that, you know, to help other people other than musicians. But that's more or less how she and I began to get together and talk about certain things. And, of course, at that time, too, Mary had converted to Catholicism, and I was Catholic. So we, you know, would have a lot of things to talk about in common as far as the religion was concerned. And Mary got me to meet the person who used to fix my taxes. Bernice Daniels was her name. I stayed with Bernice for a long time, and I enjoyed Bernice. We became friends also, you know, because of Mary.
Nice. Now, you never recorded together, right?
No, I never recorded with Mary, no.
Okay.
We played a few places. There was a place called on the east side called the Embers. There was another one uptown on Broadway near 129th Street. It was owned by a policeman, the Prelude. It was a nice club, and a lot of times musicians would come up there. Billy Taylor would come in, and Monk would come in towards the end of the evening. I remember we were playing at a club on the east side, you know, George, and then Dizzy Gillespie would come in and sit in with us. It was just a beautiful experience with her.
So once you left working with Cecil Taylor and you recorded your solo debut, what about?
That's right.
At what point did you start? Well, I guess some time happened in between before you started recording on Black Saint Soul Note Records?
Well, that one was on BYG Records.
Right.
That was done in France. I think it must have been about 1969, 70, something like that. And we were still working together, but what had happened was that there was a guy named Claude Delclue. He was actually a French drummer, and he came down to St. Paul de Vence at the Beck Foundation and wanted to know whether we wanted to go back up to Paris because our stay at the Make Foundation had ended, our residency, so to speak. And there was some stuff going on up in Paris as far as recording was concerned by this company called BYG. And for some great fortuitous chance, there were a group of musicians in Paris at that time. I remember the Art Ensemble was there, Arch Shep was there, just a bunch of people, Dave Burrell. What happened was this company recorded a lot of us, and as a result, you know, there was like cross-fertilization of musicians who happened to be in town. So I remember doing the recording with Gratian Moncur called New Africa, and that was with Archie Shep, and Dave Burrell played piano. Alan Silver played bass, and Roscoe Mitchell played alto saxophone. Thank you. Recording by Jimmy Lyons with, I think Alan Silver, the bass player, was on that, with Lester Bowie and myself. And that was called Other Afternoons. Not have been able to do that here in the United States at that time anyway, because nobody here was interested in recording us. And as great as it was, we all happened to be in Paris at that time. So it was asked of me by BYG, did I want to do a recording? So I said, yeah, well, let me do this solo recording, because I had heard a number of solo recordings by some of the great drummers, Baby Dodds and Max Roach. And at that time, I just felt that thinking of the tradition and the ability for me to express myself with Cecil, etc., and the way I would think conceptually, that I thought that I would do this solo recording called What About? And I guess I never finished the question, but in my mind it was like, what about this? It was a great period of creativity for a lot of people. Incidentally, with the recording that I did with Gracian, there were four drummers who were in, and one was walking through the studio from time to time. The first two were sitting in the engineering room, and that was Billy Joe Jones and Arthur Taylor. And then sitting behind me in the studio was Kenny Clark. And then walking to and fro in the studio from time to time was Sonny Murray.
Oh, wow.
So, you know, that was quite an experience, you know, with those guys in there. And then, of course, us playing the music. And that was one experience that I don't think very many people, you know, would have, especially drummers, with the likes of those giants.
Right. Now, BYG, that was also, hopefully I'm pronouncing it correctly, because I've never actually gotten a pronunciation for this. Was that also Actuel?
Yes.
Okay.
Actuel became label when BYG was no longer BYG with the two people who were partners in the company. I think it was Jacques. It was another Jacques somebody. And they separated. So I think one of them then went to England and took all the many of the tapes with it. That became Actuel.
Okay. Since you mentioned solo and playing solo, I have to admit, I prefer hearing exchanges between musicians, but, you know, solos can be nice too. What I was wondering is, what is the benefit to you playing solo and presenting yourself as a soloist?
Well, playing solo probably is one of the most difficult things to do because, you know, you don't have anybody else to relate to in terms of having a musical conversation. So,
right.
In a sense, you have a musical conversation with yourself. But the idea is to have a concept of what you would like to do, and you go for it. So the album, What About?, one of the titles of the pieces was called What About?, and that had to do with just straight-ahead density with certain kinds of indentations in the density. In other words, when I say density, sometimes there's no space. So you just play. Like water. When you see a river, you don't see any division. You just see motion.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was another piece, I think, called Rhythmical Space. And in that piece, then I use space. And in a sense, too, you know, one could say the space was almost like another instrument. Because you play, and then you listen to what's going on, and then you play again. You know, those are concepts. Playing solo is what many instrumentalists do. Mm-hmm. Violin players play solos. Piano players play solos all the time. I heard Ron Carter play a solo with his bass one time in Canada. And it was a fantastic exhibition of technique, concept, and feeling. You know, what he did with that instrument. I've never seen anybody else do that. Knowing that you can do certain things, taking chances, et cetera, and just playing the instrument in a way that was very, very fascinating. I heard Anthony Braxton play solos with his saxophones, et cetera. Solos are nothing new.
Right.
It just depends on what a musician wants to do and what people want to listen to. You know, like you said earlier, you like instruments playing with each other, you know, different timbres. But some people, you know, like to hear solos.
Well, there's something I've noticed in your solos in particular. Well, you mentioned how you like to be conscious of the space.
Mm-hmm.
Is that your approach to playing solos generally?
Sometimes.
Okay.
It's a matter of choice, and it's a matter of what you want to say. Usually, when there is some space, it gives people time to reflect on what just happened and to anticipate what's going to happen. But then again, too, like I said, you know, you have water. And water doesn't have any space. It just flows. And that can also be a very thrilling experience.
On the subject of the loop, on that recording, you played steel pan.
Pan, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, it's steel drums.
Mm-hmm. Right. So how did that become part of your arsenal?
Well, interesting how you say part of my arsenal. It really wasn't part of my arsenal. It was in this recording studio in Pistoia, Italy, when I did the loop. See, I mean, this guy had cymbals all over the place. I mean, these gongs. And there's one piece that I call 5000 BC. I don't know if you've heard that.
Yeah.
That's on the loop.
Uh-huh.
I'm playing, you know, these gongs, et cetera. And you know, they have different timbral textures. See, because he was advertising for a cymbal company. I think they were in Pistoia. Cymbals by hand, and not the machine-built things. And in the beginning, cymbals were made by hand anyway. So he had all of that equipment, a.k.a. arsenal, in his studio. So one of the things he had in the studio was a steel drum. And I heard something in my head and started fooling around with the instrument and came up with this piece called Some Sun. It wasn't anything that was prepared before I got to the studio. But I saw it and I said, hey, let me record something on this. I said, okay, fine. Yes. That's what came out.
I really like that one.
From my Trinidadian influences.
Well, I was talking about your working with Black Saint Soul Note Records, but before I go back to that, because we didn't exactly get there, and I guess we were sort of making our way there, but I noticed you made a detour in to play with Lonnie Liston Smith. Was that true? You were on Cosmic Funk?
Listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of this program. My name's Joyce Jones, and our guest for this evening is drummer, percussionist, composer Andrew Cyril. What you're listening to right now is Cosmic Funk by Lonnie Liston Smith. This is a 1974 Flying Dutchman release. That's Lonnie Liston Smith on electric piano, Donald Smith on piano, flute on others, George Barron on soprano sax, flute and percussion, Al Anderson on electric bass, Lawrence Killian on conga and percussion, Art Gore on drums, and the continued percussion line includes Douglas Hammond, Andrew Cyril, and Ron Bridgewater. Before that, we heard Some Sun from Andrew Cyril's The Loop. That's a 1978 Ictus Records. You'll only be able to get that if you're a lucky person and you're able to find it somewhere. Before that, we heard Rims and Things from Andrew Cyril's debut release, What About?, a 1969 BYG Records release. Before that, we heard a couple of other recordings featuring Andrew Cyril from the BYG catalog, Premonitions, Jimmy Lyons from Other Afternoons, that's a 1970 BYG Records release, Jimmy Lyons alto sax, Andrew Cyril drums, Alan Silva bass, Lester Bowie on trumpet. Before that, we heard Space Spy from Gretchen Moncourt III's 1969 New Africa release. That's Gretchen Moncourt III on trombone, Andrew Cyril on drums, Alan Silva on bass, Dave Burrell on piano, Roscoe Mitchell on alto sax, and piccolo flute. Before that, we opened the program, as mentioned, Cecil Taylor, Tales, Eight Wisps from Unit Structures, a 1966 Blue Note Records release, Eddie Gale Stevens Jr. on trumpet, Jimmy Lyons on alto sax, Makonda Ken McIntyre on alto sax, oboe and bass clarinet, Cecil Taylor on piano and bells, Andrew Cyril on drums, Henry Grimes, and also Alan Silva on bass. And we opened our program with our theme, Nina Simone, I Want a Little Sugar in My Bowl, from The Very Best of Nina Simone, Sugar in My Bowl, 1967-1972. That's an RCA BMG release, originally recorded in 1967. Stay tuned for On the Bandstand with our associate producer, Hank Williams, and more from Andrew Cyril, right here on Sugar in My Bowl on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. On the web.
I don't know. Somebody else told me about that. Maybe I have that in my catalog, but I know Lonnie and I had done some work together. I had a group once, and he was playing piano, and Sam Rivers was in that group.
I know Donald Smith. You played with him.
Yeah, I played with Donald, but that was after.
Okay.
Good evening, jazz fans. This is Hank Williams, and welcome to On the Bandstand for June 26th. This segment features aerial listings of Sugar and My Bowl guests so you can see them live. This week's show wraps our coverage of the Vision Festival with the second half of an interview with drummer Andrew Surreal. You can catch him at the Village Vanguard from July 5th through 10th with saxophonist Joe Lovano, and be sure to stop by our blog for reviews, images, and interviews from Vision Fest. And we have lots more music for you this week. AZA, the exhibit of drummer Will Calhoun's visual art collaboration, is on display at the Casita Maria Center for Arts and Education in the South Bronx until July 21st, and you can see a review of this on our blog. Trombonist Craig Harris is at Harlem Mist on the 27th, presenting his new composition Triharlenium, a sound portrait of Harlem 1976 to 2006. Bassist Bob Cranshaw is at Harlem's Cassandra's Jazz Club on the 28th, and there's a free screening of What Happened, Miss Simone documentary in Brooklyn's Von King Park as part of the Summer Stage Festival on June 28th. Saxophonist Ravi Coltrane is at Birdland from the 28th to July 2nd. Organist Dr. Lonnie Smith leads his Evolution Ensemble and a trio at Jazz Standard from June 28th through July 3rd. Drummer J.T. Lewis is at the Stone on June 30th for the late set, and trombonist Steve Turay is at Smoke from July 1st through 3rd with Carl Allen and the Heritage Band. Saxophonist Gary Bartz leads a band on July 2nd, and poet Sonia Sanchez reads her work on July 4th in outdoor performances at the International African Arts Festival in Brooklyn's Commodore Barry Park on July 4th weekend. Performances are included in the festival's small suggested admission fee. Finally, harpist Brandy Younger has a weekly Sunday brunch set at Minton's in Harlem starting on July 3rd. That's all for this week. If you missed anything, full listings are on our blog. Go to sugarinmybowl.org and click the link for the blog, where you'll also find reviews, features, and jazz news. And Sugar is spelled S-U-G-A. If you're on Twitter and Facebook, look for us there too. Playlists and audio from this and previous shows are also on the website. If you like what we do, please help WBAI stay on the air by pledging whatever you can, and consider becoming a WBAI buddy with a monthly pledge. See the Support WBAI link on our website to find out more. This is Hank Williams signing off with our biweekly schedule. We're off the air next week, but we'll have updated event listings online and be back on WBAI on Sunday, July 10th. Either way you connect, we'll see you next time on the Bandstand.
Become a BAI buddy and help reduce our on-air fundraising days.
For just 33 cents a day,
$10 a month,
or more if you can afford it, you can become a BAI buddy and help your non-commercial radio station stay on the air.
BAI buddies get discounts at local shops, museums, and live events.
Become voting members of station board elections.
And receive our new WBAI tote bag.
To become a BAI buddy, go to our website, WBAI.org, and click on the link. I'm Dequi Keone Siddiqui.
And I'm Sally O'Brien. Become a BAI buddy today and keep listening to Where We Live, 8 p.m. Thursday over listener-sponsored, non-commercial WBAI New York.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much for caring.
Hi, this is Jerry Stiller. You are listening to WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web. Where are my keys? Anybody see my keys? Who took my keys?
all throughout, you're still playing with Walt Dickerson before you wind up recording with Black Saint and Soul Note Records.
Yeah, I started playing with Walt Dickerson on Prestige.
Right.
That Prestige New Jazz.
That was in the 60s.
Yeah, that was around 60, 61, something like that.
Right. And then eventually they have you working with David Murray. And you mentioned Anthony Braxton before. When I hear Anthony Braxton and David Murray and, oh, Mujal Richard Abrams and Jimmy Lyons and other folks, I think of the music that you're playing now. I guess it's a new sound or free music. And a lot of artists who play that wound up recording on Black Saint and Soul Note Records.
Mm-hmm.
How did you wind up on that label?
Now, that's an interesting story. Milford Graves and I, we had a nonprofit organization called the Institute of Percussive Studies. And we also had a record company which was not part of the nonprofit organization called IPS Records. So IPS was really an abbreviation for Institute of Percussive Studies, but we never used that name on the label. And that was because of the business situation that we decided to do in terms of having a record company that both of us owned. And, you know, we were going to produce our own records, and we did do that. Milford had one, too, before the IPS label came about. He called that Self-Reliant Project, SRP, which he had done something with Don Pullen, a duet with Don Pullen. And then there was another drummer, too, that he did something with. With the IPS record situation, I needed somebody to distribute our records in Europe. So I had met this gentleman named Giacomo Pellicciotti. And Giacomo and some other Italian partners, I don't know who they were, started this label called Black Saint. At first, they didn't ask me to record with them, but they decided to help distribute our records, the IPS records. And just to make another detour, so to speak, I'll get back to the IPS and Black Saint. There was the Jazz Composers Orchestra organization.
Yes.
Carla Bley and Mike Mantlin, those people.
Right.
And what they would also do is if musicians had produced their own records, they were distributing the records for the musicians around the country. So they were like, not the middlemen in this sense that they didn't charge us any money for the effort. And they had a lot of different people in a loft down in the Easter Village. And they had a lot of records that they were sending out, including the Watt Records, which was Colin and Mike Mantler's label. With the IPS situation and them, and they would distribute the records, that is, or JCOA in the United States. But I wanted somebody to distribute the same recordings that Milford and I made in Europe. So then this guy, Giacomo Pellicciotti, said that he would do it. And then eventually, what he said was, well, why don't you come and record for us?
Oh.
And that's how it started. Then Giacomo got out of the business in terms of being an A&R man. And then Giovanni Bonandrini took over the label, and he became like the sole owner. I don't think he had any partners. I think he perhaps was one of the partners that I didn't know about when I met Giacomo. But he was a very interesting man also. He was a man who lived in England for a while and was teaching Italian in England, if I'm not mistaken. Then he decided that he didn't want to be there and do that anymore. And then he came back to Italy, and in Milano, he began recording a great deal of musicians. I mean, there are a number of musicians who recorded for that label.
Sure.
It was Black Saint, and then it became Soul Note. And he was very dedicated to the music. He was a great person in that regard. I became one of the people that he recorded on several occasions.
I also noticed that you recorded with several of the other artists that were on that label, such as Mujal Richard Abrams. And I know of Mujal Richard Abrams in particular, and David Murray.
David Murray, right. Yeah.
Well, you had quite a stretch on that label with Black Saint and Soul Note.
What happened was Giovanni Bonandrini decided that he wanted to retire. And then his son took over the business. And Flavio, nice man, but I don't think Flavio had the same fire in his belly that his father did. So what happened eventually was Flavio sold the business to a distributing company or a company called CAM.
Right.
So with the number of recordings that I did, there are about four or five of them that I did as a leader with Soul Note. And it was a good situation insofar as when we would go to Europe to do a tour, sometimes part of the tour in terms of income and a gig it was to do a recording. So if we went down to Italy, if we were someplace close, you know, we would just contact Giovanni and tell him we were in the area. And we would work out a deal and we would go and do the recording, you know, like it was a gig someplace else. I think it turned out to be a recording, which was good. And that was done several times for Black Saint Soul Note. Thank you.
children sleeping against our skin.
So as far as the box set is concerned, you're actually being compensated for the music being used.
Well, yes, so far, but,
okay.
You know, what's happening, though, with a lot of these companies, they send you whatever it is that they sell or don't sell. And all of that, whatever it is that you might sell, goes against what it is that they paid to produce the recording. So if they don't get their money back, you know, you don't get but so much.
Oh, I see.
That's business now. Whether you want to trust them or not is another story. But sometimes, you know, when you record for somebody in a foreign country and then you want to check their books, etc., then you have to hire a lawyer from that country. Because when you sign a contract, you know, they just tell you that whatever disagreement you might have, either party, the producer or us, the musicians, then we'd have to settle it in an Italian court or with Italian attorneys. And sometimes, you know, if you want to question somebody's honesty or whatever it is, maybe the money that you have to pay a lawyer would be more than you would get in terms of royalties. It's not worth it. But it all depends on how many recordings you sell.
Now, there's one thing that I've noticed, and that's something I've encountered with other artists as well, with regard to releases, like The Loop, for instance, your release from 1978 on, was it Inctus?
I-C-T-U-S, Inctus.
Now, that's not an easy one to find, as a matter of fact. How can people find recordings that are not easy to find? Do you make them available through your website, or is there another means?
Well, if I have them, and if I want to do that, yeah, you know, we don't have those many. I mean, there, I have a few of the IPS records that I did with Milford, the Dialogue with Drums, Celebration, Junction. Those were three on IPS.
Right.
The Ictus label, I bought those tapes from a drummer who had started that label.
Mm-hmm.
And there you go again. He's an Italian young man named Andrea Centazzo, C-E-N-T-A-Z-Z-O. And, you know, he wanted a lot of the quote-unquote new music. And now this has gone back years, so you know, you're talking about new music. It was new then. But he recorded, you know, a lot of musicians in a studio that he had in Pistoia, Italy. So when I made The Loop, I went to his studio in Pistoia. He distributed some of the recordings. I mean, what he did with The Loop, you know, he made the record. And then I think, if I'm not mistaken, he decided that he couldn't carry the load anymore in terms of making the records for all of the musicians that were on his label and do the distribution. And then, too, he was a musician himself. So I think I had mentioned, like, in the last program, and I'll repeat it, you know, if you're going to be a businessman, then sometimes you just have to take care of business, you know, up and down the day. And it's very difficult sometimes to also play music and give your heart and soul and the energy that you need in order to be a fine musician to that art. Not an easy journey. So when you begin to divide your time, you have to decide on what your priorities ought to be. And business, you know, it has its own demands. So you're going to be a hell of a business person, and you got to be a hell of a business person and do what's necessary in order to be successful in that regard. And it's the same thing with the music. If you want to be a hell of a musician, you got to put the time and the energy in. And it's a daily activity, it's a daily occurrence.
Well, I notice definitely these days, as far as musicians playing this music in particular, because of how there isn't a big label behind it or big promotional people and all that, a lot of the people have to have someone creating a website for them, promoting their recordings through the website. Mm-hmm. They have to be involved in social media, a lot of things that they didn't have to be involved in the past. Where are you with regard to that responsibility?
Well, I am not that interested in producing my own recordings at this point. It's just too much. Again, you know, like I said before, I mean, I've gone through it. I've done that.
Mm-hmm.
Been there. You know, Milford and I, you know, we tried.
Right.
And, you know, what happens is you get into it, and then before you know it, there comes the IRS. See, so, I mean, we were honest. We dealt with them. We did what we said we were going to do, was of paying them taxes, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, where's your plant? You know, how many people do you hire? This, that, and the other. So it becomes very detailed. If you can't produce certain things that they want, then the question becomes why, blah, 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 blah. So, after a while, you just say, hey, look, I don't want to do that.
I guess because I'm thinking as a fan of the music and as far as locating pieces of music that may or may not be as accessible. Maybe I'm a little selfish. It's like, but people are demanding it. Why isn't it available? Sort of thing. But I hear what you're saying, though. I understand.
Well, if it's a musician-produced recording, then that's one thing. If it's by other people, then that's another thing. Then they're responsible for that. So it's not a profitable enterprise, you know, for some companies, especially with the kind of music. But the music itself, you know, it's an art form. It's a creative endeavor. And it's good for generations to come because, you know, you can still go back and hear Jelly Roll Morton, you know. You can hear Louis Armstrong. You can hear Baby Dodds. You know, you can hear Joe Jones. You know, as far as drummers, you know, are concerned.
Right. And a lot of that music is available on MP3s that you can download from iTunes or whatever, Amazon or whatever. You can download the MP3s that people have access to if you can't have the whole LP or CD or whatever.
Well, that's what is happening or is going to happen with the music that we make.
Yeah. Definitely.
So even though in the now, sometimes, you know, we don't get just rewards, but it's still going to be there. Like most works of art, you know, they last.
Because there are some recordings that I notice, like Ode to the Living Tree. That's a recording that you still can get your hands on. It was actually transferred to CD, so you can actually get your hands on it. The loop, not so easy.
Well, I own the loop. You know, if I decide that I wanted to produce it again, then I have to go through all of those things that I was about before.
Right.
Maybe I can lease it to somebody, or maybe somebody might want to buy it.
I see. In talking about the availability of releases, I got several releases when I saw you at one of the Arts for Arts salons. I was able to get several of the recordings from you directly.
Right, I remember that, and I was kind of shocked in a way. You know, because you had no hesitation.
they were available, so.
One person, you know, somebody might take one, maybe two, but you took, how many did you take?
I think it was six.
See that? It's never happened.
Well, fortunately they were there. But I noticed that several of the recordings were on the, speaking of labels, Intact.
Yeah.
Is that like your present label that you're working with?
Yeah, this guy records Trio 3 more than any other company, you know, that we have recorded for. And he just likes our music, and, you know, he likes us as a group.
And on that subject, Trio 3, how did Trio 3 become Trio 3?
Well, Trio 3 came together probably over 25 years ago. This is what happened, and from the beginning. Reggie Workman, I think, had a group called Top Shelf, and we used to play in some of the centers where people, homeless men, would live. There was one, I don't know if it's still there, down on Bedford Avenue near Atlantic. It was
the Armory.
Homeless shelter. And we did a few other things. I think maybe a prison, a hospital. Because, you know, musicians could get some of those gigs also through the union, Local 802, or sometimes with, because I know Reggie had he was working for an organization in Brooklyn, a Muse, I think he called it. So that was a nonprofit. Sometimes if you know somebody who works in those areas, they want entertainment for the people who are in those places. So we would go in and we would play. So I think it was Oliver was part of the group. I was part of the group. Marilyn Trispo would play piano. There was another young man who played violin. And we used to play in those kinds of places. So then eventually what happened was Reggie did a recording called Synthesis, and we did it for a label called Leo Records.
And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. Sugar and My Bowl is the name of the program. My name's Joyce Jones. What you're listening to in the background is Fabula from the Reggie Workman Ensemble. Synthesis is the name of this release. This is a 1994 Leo Records recording. Reggie Workman on bass, Andrew Sorrell on drums, Marilyn Crispell on piano, and Oliver Lake on reeds. Before that, we heard Gazzaloni from Trio 3 plus Jerry Allen. That's a 2009 Intact Records release at this time. Andrew Cyril on drums, Oliver Lake on alto sax, Reggie Workman on bass, and Jerry Allen on piano. Before that, we heard Nuba 1 from Andrew Cyril, Gene Lee, and Jimmy Lyons. Nuba, a 1979 Black Saint Records recording. Andrew Cyril on drums, Gene Lee on voice and poetry, and Jimmy Lyons on alto saxophone. Before that, we heard Special People by Andrew Cyril. That's the title track from his 1981 Soul Note Records release. Andrew Cyril on drums, Nick DiGeronimo on bass, David S. Ware on tenor saxophone, Ted Daniels on trumpet and flugelhorn. Before that, we heard On the Bandstand with our associate producer, Hank Williams. Stay tuned. Sugar My Bowl on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the web.
This guy had a company, I think the company was in England, if I'm not mistaken. So we did that recording with Oliver, Reggie, myself, and Rao and Crispo. And then after that, Reggie, I, and Oliver decided to say, hey, look, let's get together and form a group because together I think we might be able to find more work at that time as a group rather than as individuals. But even though we could get some gigs, you know, as individuals, sometimes it's very hard if you have a band and, you know, you're a leader. And for people to stay together, I mean, it's very, very hard, you know, to keep a group together. And then people also have their own interests, things that they want to do for themselves. So sometimes it's hard for them to stay under the aegis of one person as a leader. So 303 decided to have a group that's like a cooperative. So there is no leader. Music is the leader. So as a result, you know, we've continued to play with each other over 25 years ago.
Nice. Wow.
And we're still doing it. And the point is we enjoy doing it with each other. We bring our music and everybody works on it. So I have two great musicians who will suffer through some of the things that I write and put it out there.
As 303, you've had guests.
Yes.
Jerry Allen, Vijay Iyer, Jason Moran.
Irene Schweitzer. She's Swiss.
Irene Schweitzer, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
She's also a pianist.
She's a pianist, that's right.
So was that the idea that the visiting guest would be a pianist, or just worked out that way?
Well, it works out that way because of the places that we play. Most of the places, like Birdland, they want a piano. Not all trios have pianos. And I guess it depends on the name recognition and the drawing power of the name. When we would play at some of these places, you know, they wanted a piano with the trio. So we gave them a piano. And, you know, we don't mind playing with those guys. And, you know, it's great to have a piano play our music and perhaps the music that we introduce. It's just another voice, you know, that adds to the color.
Well, it's also fortunate that you had already recorded with those pianists as well.
Yeah, for some of the gigs. So sometimes what would happen, we'd play with the pianist and then do the recording.
Ah.
It's not always record first and then play. Sometimes a record company wants you to do something with the pianist, so you do it with the pianist. And then, you know, a club wants you to do something with the pianist, so you do it with the pianist, whether you don't have a recording or not.
Two of the recordings that I got from you featured a duet with you and Anthony Braxton. How did you decide to do these volumes?
Very interesting. I met Anthony in Europe, was on a tour that I was doing with Cecil, and I met Anthony in Paris. And how I met Anthony was Philly Joe Jones introduced me to Anthony when we were on the street.
Hmm.
And so we met each other, said hello. Like most musicians do, we see each other all over the place. And when you meet somebody for the first time, say, hey, man, how you doing? Where are you from? Blah, 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 blah. So then Joe said, hey, man, he can play. He can play. I mean, after we separated. So I said, yeah, man. I said, just look at his fingers. You can tell he can play by the way he moves his fingers. And I had heard that also, too, about Charlie Parker. You know, they said, Bird would just mess somebody's mind up if you just watched his fingers. He didn't even have to listen to the music. And then later on, I remember, well, I did some things with Braxton, with also Richard Teitelbaum, the synthesizer player. And we did some work in Pistoia, Italy, because they had concerts there. And then we went to Greece and we did some stuff together. So Braxton had always said that he always wanted to do something with me. You know, he has certain people that he likes, and he wanted to do a duet with me. So that was something that had been talked about when we would see each other from time to time. Yeah, well, let's do that. So it came to pass that Braxton was up at Wesleyan University in Connecticut, and he was up there for quite some time. And I think Braxton also got a MacArthur. So with that MacArthur, I think he did a lot of recording with a lot of different people. And there was an engineer named John Rosenberg who recorded a lot of Braxton's material. So Anthony called and said, hey, man, let's do something. And where we did it was up in the classroom at Wesleyan. Rosenberg bought his equipment, and he's a great engineer, and he set up the microphones so that he would pick up all of my sound. Anthony must have had 7 or 8 horns that he used on different pieces. You know, he's a hell of a virtuoso, reeds.
Mm-hmm.
Rosenberg set up the microphones so that he would pick up both of us, and it almost sounds like it was done in the studio. Can't tell the difference unless I told you it was not done in a studio. So then what happened was I told Patrick Lando from Intact Records that Anthony and I had recorded these duets. So he said he was interested. He wanted to hear it, and then he decided after he heard it that he wanted to put it out. So it's a volume one and a volume two.
And both volumes were recorded during one set, it seems, in on December 28th, 2002.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's called Palindrome 2002, exactly.
That's right. Dual palindrome.
Yeah, dual palindrome, right. You know, Palindrome 2002. The palindrome is, you can say the same thing one way or the other way. 2 on the end, 002, you get 2 on the front.
Okay.
002.
Got it.
So that's what we named it. For me, it's a beautiful piece of music. I mean, the compositions, just those improvisations. I had, I think, 1 or 2 that were written, if I'm not mistaken. I don't remember whether Anthony had 1 that was written, 1 or 2, but most of it was just improvised.
Okay.
I mean, I think they're beautiful listening. If you're one of these people, you know, who can sit down and listen to sound and don't expect anything that perhaps you've heard before. You're in the sound for the adventure. See what happens. And you just open yourself up to it. And when you have people who, to a large degree, can control themselves, control the instrument in so many different ways, and have a conversation with each other, you can get some beautiful stuff.
That's what I like about ensembles.
And then, you know, you see, instrumental music is something to which you can add your own words. You can think of whatever you want. When you have singers singing with instrumental music, you no longer have the freedom of thinking what you want to think. You listen to what they say, and that's what you think. And, you know, with the poetry is beautiful. I mean, songs are fantastic. They're great. But they're words written by somebody else. They're said by somebody else. But with the instruments alone, just think what you want to think.
Now, 2 things I want to ask you before we wrap up. One of the things is working with Amiri Baraka. Speaking of poets, and words. What was that experience? Because I've seen you at the Vision do this, and you were also involved in a recording with Roswell Rudd when Amiri was featured on that.
Yeah, Roswell and Nazi Shep.
Right, exactly.
Reggie Workman.
Exactly.
And Grayson Moncur.
Indeed. What is it like working with Amiri for you?
Well, Amiri was a musician himself. He uses the words as his instrument, period.
Right.
There is also a video that was made by a French person. I don't remember this guy's name, but it's a CD with Amiri, me, and Santi Debriano. We did it at the New Eurekan Poets place.
It's on 3rd Street on the Lower East Side, right, the New Eurekan Poets Cafe.
That's right, and that's where we did it. And, you know, this guy had his camera, et cetera. And it's a trio with Amiri. You know, I did work with Amiri and David Murray in Central Park in New York. You know, a lot of things. You know, Amiri was just one of those guys that put himself in the music. You know, like, again, when I first met Amiri, it was with Cecil Taylor and Jimmy Lyons and Henry Grimes. You know, I don't remember whether Amiri was part of the music that day because he did recite his poetry, but he was around it, and he's always been around it. I mean, you know, in a sense, it was like, again, like he was a musician. He just didn't play an instrument. He played his voice with the poetry, and that was his sound.
Right.
He was really dedicated and inside the stuff. And in that light, he was a great person. Like most instrumentalists, let's say, in a rhythm section, and I'm talking about like horn players, you know, they sit on top of the rhythm and they play what they play. And that's what Amiri did with words. So he listened and, you know, he recited some great words with magnificent vision. Some people liked what he said and some people didn't. But it was still something that I don't think a lot of poets don't do. I've seen Quincy do that, Quincy Troupe do that,
right,
you know, on occasion. But Quincy hasn't done it as much as Amiri has.
Right. So the last thing I'd like to ask you about is teaching.
Yes.
You're at the New School.
Uh-huh.
And you've been at other institutions before that, I believe.
Yeah, right. Antioch.
Right. What does that do for you, teaching?
Well, number one, it keeps me from being bored and feeling despondent or depressed, you know, because I'm in the house maybe contemplating my navel or something like that. So, you know, it gives me something to do. And on top of that, I learn from teaching. And a lot of those students at the New School are brilliant. And we exchange ideas. They come up with their material. I give them material. And it just keeps me active. Gets me out of the house.
What is your subject?
Improvisation with ensembles. You know, I have two ensembles that I teach on a given day. And sometimes I have private students. And I don't only have drummers, you know, the private students. I might have a cello player, I might have a flute player, a piano player, saxophone players, bass players, anybody who wants to be involved with me, a drummer. And they ask me all kinds of questions in relationship to the music that I play, what they play. So we learn, and, you know, I give them what it is that I hope will benefit them. And most of them appreciate it. And let me put it this way. I like teaching. I like teaching very much. I love to play. Understand?
Oh, yeah.
When I'm not playing, I'm playing in my mind with the students. And again, you know, it's a very rewarding activity. It's work, but it's work that I welcome.
That's great. Well, thank you so much, Andrew Cyril, for joining us for part two. I'm glad we were able to find out more about you and about your music.
And thank you so much, Joyce, for asking such poignant and brilliant questions.
Oh, that's so kind of you. All right, have a good night.
All right, and you do the same.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. Sugar in My Bowl is the name of the program of which you've been listening. My name's Joyce Jones. What you're listening to in the background is Ode to the Living Tree from our guest for this evening, Andrew Cyril. This is the Andrew Cyril Quintet from his 1997 Evidence Records release, Ode to the Living Tree. Andrew Cyril on drums, Oliver Lake on alto sax, Fred Hopkins on bass, Adegoke Steve Colson on electric piano, David Murray on tenor sax, bass clarinet on others. Stay tuned for La Nueva Alternativa. It is scheduled to happen after Sugar My Bowl. We will not be here next week, but we will be back on July 10th. And hopefully we'll have something special for you then. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, WBAI.org on the web. Keep listening.
Hello. Bueno, this is Sonia Sanchez. I urge you to give your generous support to listener-sponsored community radio, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York.